United States v. Sutton. Mr. Henderson.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Peter Henderson, and I represent Gene Sutton. I was appointed to brief one of the legal issues in this case to supplement Mr. Sutton's briefs, and so I'll focus on that legal issue, but I'm happy to answer questions about Mr. Sutton's arguments as well. The legal issue largely is semantic and largely is decided. In United States v. Shaw last month, the court adopted the type of approach to motions under the First Step Act that we have advocated for in this appeal. The First Step Act, as the court noted, is a novel statute. It permits district courts to revisit sentences that would otherwise be final, and it itself contains the grant of authority, and that authority is broader than authority that would be granted by provisions in Section 3582. That statute deals only with the term of imprisonment, whereas the First Step Act permits a court to reduce the entire sentence, including the term of imprisonment, the term of supervised release, any fine. And so if a defendant wishes to reduce his total sentence, he should file a motion under the First Step Act. There may be some interaction. Well, first of all, let me get out of the way. Section 3582C2 plainly does not apply. Neither party has argued that it does, and the court in Shaw said that it does not apply. That applies to amendments to the sentencing guidelines. Section 3582C1B may have some application, but I think the technical sort of quibble is that it doesn't govern so much as it facilitates a review of the term of imprisonment.
Mr. Henderson, this is Judge St. Eve. How would Rule 43 play in with your argument under the First Step Act? In other words, would the defendant's presence be required under Rule 43 when the court imposes a reduced sentence? Or is that something that is within the court's discretion?
We have not made the argument that a defendant's presence is required. It certainly seems akin to a decision. I guess how I would analogize it is something like a Section 2255 motion, which also, if resentencing is granted or if the sentence is modified, would technically fall under 3582C1B, although the source of the relief is Section 2255. And in that situation, the court, I think, has discretion to either modify a sentence, correct a sentence, or order resentencing as it sees fit. And that decision would then be viewed for an abuse of discretion. And so in the 2255 context, if there's an error in the sentence, there doesn't necessarily need to be a full resentencing hearing. The district judge can simply correct the sentence without having to adhere to Rule 43. And so I think that that's the approach. But the flip side of that is to say if the court wishes to have the defendant present, there's certainly nothing wrong with that. That wouldn't be an abuse of discretion. What the court, I think, emphasized in Shaw is that, you know, this is a new statute, and district judges are really given a lot of discretion to determine what they want to do with these types of motions. So in our district, for example, we've got one judge who every motion gets a hearing with a video conference with the defendant present. Another judge has no hearings and enters everything by text order.
And it's your position that any of those actions are fine. It's really up to the district court's discretion.
I think there certainly could be instances where the judge abuses his or her discretion. But it's hard to think of examples. The example in Shaw had to do with defendant Robinson, where a district judge didn't hold a hearing, and so that there wasn't any record. from the hearing itself, and the explanation for denying the motion was really too summary to really facilitate appellate review. And so that would be the type of thing where the district court needs to do more to explain, you know, if we're looking at this from the point of view of the Court of Appeals, the district court needs to do something to explain how it's using its discretion. But it does have the discretion, I think. It just needs to explain in a reasoned way how it's using that discretion.
Mr. Henderson, I know you weren't asked to brief this aspect, but if I could turn, please, and have a question for you on the actual denial of the motion and whether or not that was an abuse of discretion. Why isn't that question moot now in light of the fact that the defendant was released from prison last month?
So there are a couple reasons why it's not moot. The first one is very practical, and it has to do with the way that the Bureau of Prisons credits time to a sentence. So Mr. Sutton was sentenced to 180 months in prison. He served a 180-month sentence. If Mr. Sutton were to prevail on appeal and convince the district court to reduce that prison term to, say, 168 months, the Bureau of Prisons would consider that he basically has a year of credit on this case, so that if his supervised release were to be revoked and he was sentenced to 2 years further imprisonment, he would already have credit for a year.
Why wouldn't that be an argument? We all hope that there's no revocation of supervised release, but why wouldn't that be an argument that would more appropriately be made if there is a revocation hearing, as opposed to now to reverse, send back, have a court resentence somebody to a lower sentence when he's already out of prison?
Well, I think that you're right, that is the better argument. But in terms of, you know, whether this case is moot, there is some potential benefit to Mr. Sutton. There's another reason for avoiding mootness, and it's actually the case of Pope versus Purdue. I'll try to pull it up. But Mr. Sutton's currently serving a 5-year term of supervised release. After a year is up, first of all, Mr. Sutton has alluded in his briefing, most of these motions where the defendant was convicted under Section 841B1A and now would be subject to Section 841B1B, in the district court, most of those motions, we have been reducing the term of supervised release from the minimum years. That didn't happen in Mr. Sutton's case.
Did Mr. Sutton ask for that in his motion?
No, I don't think he did, not from my review of his motion.
So again, it seems like that's something, if he has a second bite at the apple, he could go back and ask the court to reduce his term of supervised release on that basis. Again, assuming he can get a second bite at the apple.
Yes, I think that's right. In terms of mootness, I think the answer is provided. Pope versus Purdue is 889 Federal 3rd 410. And basically, after Mr. Sutton has served even just a year on supervised release, he may move to reduce the term of supervised or to terminate the term of supervised release under Section 3583. And so if this court determines that the denial of this First Step Act motion was an error, even though he can't get any of that prison sentence back, he would have a better argument for early termination of supervised release.
Since he didn't raise the supervised release request below when he brought his First Step Act motion for reduction, would that aspect of the argument be premature?
I don't think so. He has raised it a little late in the game. That's true. But he could make a motion in about a year's time to terminate his term of supervised release. And if there were a favorable decision in this appeal, he could cite to this appeal and say, look, I served more time than I should have. You should terminate my supervised release rather than, you know, reduce it from 5 to 4, something like that.
So Mr. Henderson, it's Judge Scudder. Is that one of the things I've struggled with the same question because we're about 10 years after the fact now, at least, and the defendant wants a remand to resolve, thus far unresolved challenges to drug quantity findings and the like in the PSR. So is it his view, and I know you didn't brief this, but we have the benefit of you being on the phone now, so I can just ask you. Is it his view that we should remand and that the point of the remand will be for the district court to resolve whatever challenges Mr. Sutton had to the drug quantity findings or anything else for that matter that made up the computation of the applicable sentencing guideline range?
I think so. I think that there are two basic arguments that he's made. One is that the government should be held to what he perceives to be its promise to recommend the statutory minimum sentence. And the other would be, let me characterize it the way that I would say it. According to Mr. Sutton's view, his guidelines range ought to be about 87 to 108 months. The drug quantity actually doesn't matter. The dispute was about powder cocaine, and the base offense level was set by the crack cocaine. But there's a five-level swing because he got an obstruction of justice enhancement and thus did not get an acceptance of responsibility enhancement. Right. And that makes the huge difference in the range. And so I think what I would ask for is a remand for the district judge to evaluate those arguments, because what happened here is the district judge basically said, well, probation said this is the guidelines range, and so his sentence is way below, and so I'm not, I don't see any reason to reduce it. But that guidelines range was never established at the original sentencing. So that doesn't necessarily require a resentencing hearing. The district judge has a lot of discretion to determine how to deal with that sort of challenge to the guidelines range. But it at least should tell us how it's resolving that challenge instead of simply adopting the view of the probation office.
Mr. Henderson.
Unless there are other.
Into rebuttal, but I will give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor.
All right. And Mr. Simpson, you may have 12 minutes for argument in light of the time allowed for the appellant.
Thank you, Judge Baum. So good morning, Your Honors. This is Scott Simpson with the Department of Justice on behalf of the United States, and may it please the court. First of all, can I make sure everyone hears me all right?
Yes, we can hear you.
Great. Thank you, Judge St. Eve. Maybe if I could, first of all, before getting into the vehicle question posed by the court, especially since the court has raised some issues about the district court's exercise of its discretion, if I could first address a few things about that. We think that decision was well within the court's discretion, as the court has already discussed with Mr. Henderson. Sutton's current sentence of 180 months was actually less than 75% of the bottom of his guidelines range in 2009. And even after the application of the First Step Act, his sentence is still only 85% of the bottom of his guidelines range. During Mr. Henderson's argument, there were some references to Mr. Sutton's objections to the pre-sentence investigation report. The district court's decision denying the motion to reduce his sentence under the First Step Act referred to the fact that in entering into a sentencing agreement, which Mr. Sutton did, he withdrew those objections to the PSR. So his sentence of 180 months that we are dealing with, the sentence that the district court imposed, is based on that sentencing agreement. And again, in that agreement, he withdrew the objections to the PSR.
Mr. Simpson, where in the record is it clear that he withdrew his objections when he entered into that agreement?
Well, Your Honor, I guess I would start with the fact that, in denying the motion for reduction of sentence, the district court found that he had withdrawn those objections to the PSR.
And I'm trying to figure out what that was based on, where in the record, because I know it's hard. This is district court judge, is not the district court judge who sentenced him originally. So going back through and trying to put things together in addressing this question, what did the district court rely on in making the determination that the defendant withdrew his objections?
I'm not entirely clear on that, Your Honor. One thing that I think we need to keep in mind in relation to the procedural history of this case early on, the defendant pleaded guilty, sentencing, and he entered his objections to the PSR. Sentencing did not actually occur for, I'm not sure how long, several months. There were very long negotiations leading up to the sentencing agreement. And again, those negotiations took place in the context of the defendant's objections to the PSR, which had already been imposed. And so my supposition, based on my review of the record, is that the judge felt that what the government gave up was that the government gave up quite a bit in the course of agreeing to the 180 months. And based on that long negotiation, in the context of the objections to the PSR, I think that's why the court concluded that the government agreed to that low sentence in exchange for the defendant giving up his objections to the PSR. And that's actually what the judge's order said in denying the motion to reduce sentence. He said that in exchange for the 180 month very low sentence, that what the defendant gave up was his objections to the PSR. Unless there are other questions on the discretionary decision by the court, I'll move on to the vehicle question.
Before you do that, Mr. Simpson, what's the government's position on the mootness of this in light of the fact that he has since been released from prison? I know it was after the filing of the briefs and after the subsequent briefing as well, but last month, Mr. Sutton was released.
Yes, and we did in our supplemental brief say that we were not pressing a jurisdictional a mootness argument, that we agreed with the defense counsel's argument that the case was not moot. And I think that that position that we took was based on the statements, on the observations that Mr. Henderson made. Now, that having been said, obviously it is a jurisdictional question. The government, again, is not pressing a jurisdictional issue, but we recognize, of course, that the court has to ensure itself of its jurisdiction. We believe there is jurisdiction here. We agree with what Mr. Henderson has said about the lack of mootness. But again, that having been said, we certainly recognize that it's up to the court, and the court can still find that there is no jurisdiction.
What's the government's view on the proper remedy if we were to determine that there was an abuse of discretion in denying the motion?
I believe this court would remand for another decision by the district court, and the court would be deciding if Mr. Sutton were still in prison, what sentence would I be ordering? And as Mr. Henderson has said, I think that would, even though Mr. Sutton is no longer in prison, I think that would have an effect on, among other things, on any later motion to reduce his term of supervised release.
So, Mr. Simpson, it's Judge Scudder. So does that hinge upon, if we were to conclude, for example, if we were to conclude that Mr. Sutton did not withdraw any objections to the PSR or the guidelines calculation connection with entering into the original sentencing agreement, but rather that those objections were mooted by virtue of the agreement, would we remand then? I know that's not what you're urging us, but if we say they were just mooted by virtue of the sentencing agreement, would we remand then, and Judge Shadid could take it all up, could take the objections up, et cetera, from there?
I assume Judge Shadid could take up the objections in his discretion. As we discussed, during defense counsel's argument, the district court has broad discretion in a decision to reduce a sentence under the First Step Act. So I suppose Judge Shadid could choose to consider those objections, the government's position would be that would be improper because the government agreed to the 180-month sentence in exchange for Mr. Sutton's withdrawal of those objections.
Right. Okay.
So on the procedural vehicle, the bottom line here is that we are asking this court to reach the same conclusion that four other circuit courts have reached on this question. We have to fit Section 404 of the First Step Act into the overall statutory scheme rather than looking at Section 404 in isolation. So the analysis has to start with the overall statutory prohibition in 3582C, that is, the Sentencing Reform Act's statement that a court may not modify a term of imprisonment once it has been imposed. That statute embodies Congress's clear intent to deprive the courts of any inherent continuing authority over sentences. The statutes clearly reflect an intent that that sentences generally be final. And Section 404 neatly fits within that overall scheme, that is, into the exception in Section 3582C1B that a court can modify a term of imprisonment to the extent expressly permitted by some other statute. So Section 3582C is the general prohibition. Section 3582C1B is a placeholder for later exceptions that may be enacted, and Congress simply plugged in one of those exceptions by enacting Section 404. I'm not sure how the scheme could be any clearer than that. The defense asserts that the question of the correct vehicle here is just a semantic question, but apparently this court thought otherwise because it has posed a question. So we ask the court to hold, along with those four other circuits, that the proper vehicle is a motion under 3582C1B. Now, that doesn't necessarily answer all questions as to how a court should go about determining a new sentence if the court exercises its discretion to reduce the sentence. The mechanics of that process, such as considering the 3553A factors, those are other questions, and we would urge the court in this case to defer those questions of mechanics to cases in which the issues are presented in a concrete factual context, as they were in Shaw, for example. Two other cases that are still pending before the court, Speed and Vortiz. Speed is 19-2708 and Vortiz is 19-2476. Some of those issues perhaps are pending there, but those questions of measuring the amount of a reduction are not presented here, we think. So that basically completes my argument. Are there any further questions from the court?
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Simpson. Mr. Henderson?
Okay, so just to sum up, if I could, please.
Yeah, surely.
So we urge the court to affirm. We urge the court to affirm the district court's denial of Sutton's motion for reduction of sentence, and answering the question posed by the court to hold that the proper vehicle under the First Step Act is a motion under Section 3582C1B. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Simpson. Mr. Henderson?
I just wanted to answer Judge St. Eve's question about where in the record we can find the answer to our dispute about withdrawal of objections or mooting of objections. On page 53 of the sentencing transcript, which is docketed as number 85, what defense counsel says is that it would be our position, the United States and the defense agree to disagree on the objections that we raised. Talking about acceptance of responsibility, obstruction of justice, the amount of drugs. And so what happens in the addendum to the PSR that was filed after sentencing, Judge McCuskey wrote that all objections are moot and not necessary to be ruled on because of the sentencing agreement. And so to the extent that Judge Shadid understood that Mr. Sutton had withdrawn his objections rather than agreeing that they were moot because of the sentencing agreement, that would have been an error. And so that certainly could justify a remand for reconsideration, just so that this court knows exactly how Judge Shadid is using his discretion in the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson. Thank you, Mr. Simpson. The case is taken under advisement.